Support for WKAR is provided by MSU Alumni Association, offering opportunities for networking, alumni enrichment, and community involvement with MSU alumni in your area and across the country. alumni.msu.edu. And by Astera Credit Union, a proud supporter of Current State's Neighbors in Action segment. Newest location is now open on West Saginaw Highway on Lansing's west side. Information at asteracu.com.
Welcome back to Current State. The skies were mainly clear last night, which would have offered a great opportunity to take in some meteors. The Perseid meteor shower is unfolding here these few nights, as it happens every year in August. I made it out briefly, but I didn't see anything. So I have to settle for pictures online, which can be pretty impressive, but maybe we'll try again tonight. I do believe the weather should cooperate if it's not too late already. But welcome back to Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. I want to thank everybody for stopping by the East Lansing Folk Festival on Friday. WKAR's Current State was there, and we had a smashing time, and we expect to be out and about again soon with the program. At the top of the program today, Michigan health officials and physicians have launched an awareness-raising effort to get more young people vaccinated. The move comes after data showing an increase in the number of Michigan parents choosing not to get their kids vaccinated. Last year, more than 7,000 kindergartners alone in the state had some kind of vaccination waiver. Michigan is one of 20 states that allow such waivers for philosophical reasons. These waivers often include skepticism that vaccines are essential, that they may be harmful, and that not enough is known about the cumulative effect of various vaccines. Well, with the 2013 school year just a few weeks away, Current State thought we'd explore the issue some more. To help us with that, we welcome two guests. Dr. Matt Davis is Chief Medical Executive in the State Department of Community Health. Dr. Davis, welcome to Current State.
Thanks for having me.
And Mary Tocco is the Director of Vaccine Research and Education for the group Michigan Opposing Mandatory Vaccine. She's also the creator of the website childhoodshots.com. Hi, Mary.
Hi, Mark. Good morning.
Good morning. Mary, let's start with you. When and how did you first become skeptical about vaccinations?
Well, Mark, back in 1980, when I was having my first child, I began to look at all the information that was available for parents on vaccinations, and I was shocked because there was very little information that was easy, accessible. So I went on and I ordered about 15 books, which was every book I could get my hands on. And the more I read, the more concerned I was about what was being injected into our children. I learned about vaccine ingredients like mercury and aluminum and phenol, acetal, formaldehyde. And basically, we decided to not vaccinate our children on the information that I was able to gather. And then as I saw the number of vaccines go up, I also saw the autism crisis emerge, and I believe the two are directly related. So I continued researching, and now I am considered a vaccine expert, and I speak across America and Canada. I do not tell parents what to do or how to believe. I simply report the facts about vaccine production, ingredients, and let people decide what is best for them. Because really, I believe it is a medical health choice that parents must make for their children.
And what in 2013 concerns you the most in terms of the ingredients in vaccines?
Well, there still is mercury in the vaccines, even though they refer to it as a trace amount. It exceeds any safety levels that have ever been set. I'm very concerned about the aluminum levels. When they reduce the mercury, they increase the aluminum. And all of my research basically shows that we're giving our children injections of lethal doses almost. For many children, it is lethal, or it can cause severe neurological damage. So I do believe the number one concern for myself and for parents out there as I speak and do radio programs is the safety of vaccinations and the ingredients. With the internet now, Mark, we have so much information available to us that a parent can simply Google a vaccine manufacturer's insert and see for themselves what kind of bioengineered viruses their children will be given, or the levels of aluminum and mercury. And so really, I think what's going on is with the, we have a vaccine education revolution taking place where people are learning more and more about vaccines, and they're not comfortable with what is happening.
Let's bring Dr. Matt Davis into the conversation. At the top here, Matt, what vaccinations does the state of Michigan require of kids attending school? Let's clarify that since we're just about at another school year.
Sure. So, Mark, like many other states in the United States, what we do in Michigan is to have a vaccine mandate for entry into kindergarten and then related to sixth grade as well. This was passed by legislators in an effort to protect the health of kids in the state and also to protect the health of the adults in their communities. In fact, we know from good examples that we've had from vaccines that not only has the rate of vaccine-preventable diseases like polio, diphtheria, pneumococcal disease gone down among children, but it has also decreased among adults, even those who haven't received these vaccines. So this is a very good idea for us as a community, and that's what led the state legislature to say this should be part of what we do here in Michigan for our kids and for our communities. So what we do is we recommend certain vaccines that are recommended by the CDC and require them for entry, and those are the diphtheria, tetanus, and pertussis vaccine, polio vaccine, measles, mumps, rubella vaccine, hepatitis B, varicella, and meningococcal vaccine.
How do you respond to Mary Toko's concerns here over the components of these vaccines, though? I mean, she's mentioned some fairly lethal-sounding components, mercury, aluminum, formaldehyde. How do we put that in perspective?
These are common concerns that I hear. As well as being the chief medical executive for the state, I'm also a primary care pediatrician. And I have parents like Mary in my practice who express their concerns about what's in those vaccines. So here's how I respond. First of all, what's lethal here are the infections that we are designing vaccines and giving vaccines to prevent. That's what's lethal. Polio is lethal. Diphtheria is lethal. Pertussis can be lethal for infants. Measles can be lethal. Pneumococcal vaccine, meningitis can be lethal. Those diseases can be lethal. And that's been the marvelous improvement we've had in population health over the past century because vaccines have given us this gift of protection. A gift of protection when we can protect kids and communities and not have to worry about those individuals getting potentially lethal infections that vaccines can prevent. While it is true that when Mary started looking at this in 1980, there were certainly components of vaccines that would raise concern. Issues like mercury, for example, substances like mercury called thimerosal, have actually been removed from the vast majority of vaccines. Aluminum is part of them. Formaldehyde has been part of them. I think we would all be probably surprised if we took a look at the components of a lot of medications that are there.
But continue. Yes. Continue.
What I think it's important to clarify the record about the association of autism and vaccines. That was proposed by a researcher in the United Kingdom named Andrew Wakefield, who has since been discredited for the inauthentic and actually falsified records that he put together. He has been removed as a member of the physician community in the United Kingdom, and his work has been removed from the record.
Mary Toko, let me follow up on that point with you. A number of the studies linking vaccinations to autism have been debunked. In your mind, where is the research on this?
Well, first of all, Dr. Matt, I did that. I don't think he addressed the issue of the toxicity level of the mercury and the aluminum. And I do believe that that is an issue that we must address. A trace amount of mercury, just so you know, In the allowable amount that's in water, for example, is we allow 200 parts per billion in drinking water. If we have 200 parts per billion of mercury, it is rendered a toxic waste. In fish, the allowable amount of mercury is up to 1,600 parts per billion. And the infant child vaccination that contains mercury contains up to 25,000 parts per billion. And also the flu vaccine for adults that contains mercury contains 50,000 parts per billion. I can go into the aluminum levels as well. So I don't think the doctor addressed that issue. And I think people really need to understand that there are two sides to this issue that most pediatricians never really address. Secondly, there is a tremendous amount of evidence that shows that the death rate from all of these infectious illnesses had dropped off dramatically, up to 90 to 100% before vaccines were even introduced. And credit has been given to the vaccinations for eradicating or reducing these illnesses when, in fact, scientific statistics show differently. For example, smallpox. Only 10% of the world got the smallpox vaccine. And yet you hear all the time that we have eradicated smallpox with the vaccination, and that just, you can't claim that with only 10% of the people in the world getting smallpox. So death rate for illnesses was down dramatically and does not warrant mass vaccinations. And I have all of this on my website under infectious illnesses.
Matt Davis, is there unfinished business here regarding toxicity levels in your view, or is this issue been put to bed?
Well, I want to respond on a couple levels. First of all, I recognize that parents still have concerns. I'm a parent myself. I'm a health policy researcher at the University of Michigan as well. And
thimerosal is still a part of some influenza and tetanus and other vaccines.
It is still a part of some vaccines, though it has been removed from the majority of vaccines. And I think it's important for us to say if thimerosal, the mercury component that Mary's talking about, has been removed for vaccines in the time that autism has been increasing, then how scientifically can we make a connection between thimerosal and autism? It doesn't make scientific – there's no scientific connection there. And in fact, all of the studies that have been done about mercury exposure through vaccines and autism have disproved any link. Furthermore, other concerns that parents have raised, and I do understand the concerns being raised, and when we look into them, for example, hepatitis B vaccine and multiple sclerosis, those have also been disproved. I certainly understand the sense that parents don't want to expose their kids to unnecessary risk. But the fact of the matter is that when you look at the history of infectious diseases, the dramatic decline in infectious disease occurred with vaccines, not prior to vaccines.
Mary Tocco, let's get you to respond to that point.
What
about situations where the threat of the disease, say measles, appears to clearly outweigh any potential threat from the vaccine?
Well, first of all, I will say that as we have increased the number of vaccines, we also have chronic illness in children growing up. And there has not been any studies whatsoever to disprove that vaccines do not lead to autism. They basically have not done the proper studies. The studies that have been done have been found to be terribly flawed. People could go to a website called 14studies.org, and they can look at every study that the CDC and the American Academy of Pediatrics references, and they will find that there's a tremendous amount of conflict of interest. The studies are funded by the drug companies who make the vaccines. The safety studies are just not done properly. Secondly, I will say that there is a tremendous amount of conflict of interest in all of the regulatory boards in Washington. So many people do not trust what's coming out of the CDC or the FDA. So that's one way I would respond. Also,
let's let Matt Davis respond to that.
I think it's a very fair comment that there is conflict of interest. We know there is conflict of interest between the pharmaceutical industry and regulatory authorities. I totally agree with Mary about that. That's why I think as parents and as primary care clinicians, pediatricians, family physicians, nurse practitioners, et cetera, we need to make informed decisions about how we try to protect our kids' health. I have parents like Mary and her families in my practice who have opted out of vaccinating their kids, not just to say I don't want the mandate, but actually say I don't want the vaccines. I understand that decision. I have those families in my clinic, and I try to help protect those kids against situations where they may be exposed to multiple other vaccine-preventable diseases that I am positive those families don't want their kids to have. But I will say from my experience in my practice over the last decade and a half that many of those families have decided to vaccinate their kids. Why? Because they have had cousins or relatives or even one of their kids die as a result of a vaccine-preventable disease like pertussis. These are preventable diseases. It is a tragedy when one of them takes one of our kids' lives.
Yeah, Matt Davis, has enough been studied with regard to the combination, the cumulative effects of all of these? I mean, a young person can get an awful lot of vaccinations. I want to say I read 2 dozen. It's not uncommon for a six-year-old to have had 2 dozen vaccinations by that age. Do we know enough about that?
I would say I would like to see continuing research on the safety of vaccines. I think we need to continue to do it because as we try to protect our kids, we need to make certain that the balance of benefit outweighs any risks.
Mary, what about the cumulative effects of these vaccines? I know that's on your radar.
Yes. I would say, first of all, in other countries where they have not vaccinated before the age of two, such as Japan, they have seen SIDS rates and other things go away because the vaccines were causing SIDS. I guess the best analogy for me to make, and this is something that I can just ask everybody, if I took an apple and I injected that apple with phenol and acetone and thousands of bioengineered viruses that are made in laboratories that are not found in nature, and millions of bacteria and some aluminum and phenol, would you eat the apple or would you feed it to your infant?
Well, it's different being spread out over a period of years, though. Wouldn't you agree? I mean, that's a pretty toxic scenario that you create there. But
yes,
over a period of years, doesn't that change the dynamic?
No, I think if you just took a regular vaccination and injected it into an apple, those are the ingredients that you would find in the average vaccine. People can go to a website, novaccine.com, and look up all the ingredients. But my point is we don't feel comfortable eating phenol and acetone or formaldehyde and millions of viruses and bacteria that are bioengineered in a lab. How can we possibly think that it's acceptable to inject this into newborn children who have underdeveloped immune systems the day they're born? The hepatitis B vaccination,
the aluminum levels
are off the chart for hepatitis B vaccine.
Mary, we're just about out of time. Let's give Matt Davis a brief second to respond here. Matt?
Okay.
I think Mary's points about what we're injecting into our kids, I certainly understand as a level of concern as a parent. I get it. I want to be able to say to my families that I vaccinate, that I help that vaccinate their kids, and that as the chief medical executive for the state that we're requiring for entry into school, that this is worth the investment in our kids and worth any risk that's there. I firmly believe that the program we have in place in our state is designed to protect kids, and it does a great job of doing that.
I'm afraid we've got to leave it there. Mary Tocco is the director of vaccine research and education for the group Michigan Opposing Mandatory Vaccines. Dr. Matt Davis is chief medical executive in the State Department of Community Health. Thanks to both of you. It's Current State on WKAR. Thanks for joining us. About 250 miles southeast of where I'm speaking to you here in East Lansing is the town of East Lake, Ohio. 10 years ago today, an electric generation plant in that small Cleveland suburb went offline, triggering the largest power outage in U.S. history.
Good evening from our NBC News headquarters in Midtown Manhattan, where we are in the midst of what appears to be a colossal and history-making blackout. Not just this city, but
the blackout of 2003. After a night without light, power still out for millions. Travel is very difficult.
What is the situation in Michigan right now?
Well, there are three cities without power in Michigan. Detroit, of course, being the largest. Stretches over to the west into the Ann Arbor area and then on to the state capital in Lansing.
The Northeast blackout of 2003 affected 10 million people in Canada and 45 million Americans. Here in Michigan, more than 2 million homes and businesses went dark, mostly in Metro Detroit. Since then, many electricity providers across the country have invested in their own systems, including Consumers Energy based in Jackson. Here to talk about the lessons learned from the Great Northeast Blackout of 2003 is Garrick Rochow, Vice President of Energy Delivery for Consumers Energy. Mr. Rochow, welcome to Current State.
Good morning. How are you?
Real good. To what extent was Michigan affected here 10 years ago?
Well, we certainly had, as you indicated there, the Metro Detroit area was the hardest hit. It extended over to the Lansing area into the Consumers Energy Service territory. But interesting enough, when you have that kind of disruption on the electric grid, it causes problems at power plants throughout the Midwest. And even as far as the west side of the state, Lake Michigan, we had problems with some of our power plants and had to take some offline as a result of the incident. I can remember that day very clearly. It was one of those, I had just left work, and I got the calls at the bank, and they said, come back to the power plant immediately. So,
when a power station has a failure like this, like they had in East Lake, Ohio, can you talk to us about the procedures technicians follow to restore power?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, from a power plant perspective, what happens there is, in our control room, there's a number of safety procedures we have to securely shut down the plant and make it to a safe condition. And so they're trained, they're qualified to do those types of things. Because typically a generator will try to speed up to meet the demand or to meet the load, and that can cause process problems. But on the line side, where the customers are, when you have that type of outage, our crews, our engineers, our teams go into action to make sure transformers are safe and we're not damaged, but also we can start throwing in switches or putting power back to customers in an orderly fashion. You have to do that so you can restore the grid in a systematic format.
10 years ago, did Michigan see any really serious effects? I mean, were there fatalities? Were there hospitals without power, that kind of thing?
No, nothing in terms of fatalities or hospitalizations specifically with our system. Again, but a lot of lessons learned in terms of coordination between utilities. And this originated a power plant, but more importantly a line, a transmission line that has overloaded and sagged into some trees in an Ohio area that caused that ripple effect across the east and northeast. And as Consumers Energy, we've been investing, millions of dollars, $45 million plus over the last few years in vegetation or tree trimming to ensure that we have reliability not only in that peak load or that hot day as occurred back in August of 10 years ago, but to provide reliable power to our customers all the time.
Were you arguably, Garrick, were you arguably underinvested in those measures before?
No, it was more, and let me say, too, there was a number of lessons learned for the entire utility industry, and it really had to do with coordination between utilities.
Yeah, you mentioned that. Tell us more about
that. Yeah, relay settings, protective settings, and the like. And so there's a lot more activity and communication between control rooms and coordination between transmission companies to make sure that that does not happen. To answer your question specific on investments, we've invested more in our reliability, not necessarily, well, one, because of the blackout, but also because it provides great customer satisfaction and value. Our customers expect less outages, whether it's because of a blackout condition or a weather condition, and that's why we've made investments, and that's why we've seen improvement in reliability across our state.
Who had the bigger challenge 10 years ago, you or DTE? I think it was primarily hit Detroit, so I'm thinking maybe DTE had an even bigger challenge than you did.
Yeah, I can't speak to the nature of DTE not being an employee of DTE, but certainly from a customers that were impacted, DTE certainly had a larger share of customers impacted. And as I indicated, it takes a while to bring those customers back on. You have to do it in a systematic format so you don't overload the grid when you're bringing customers on.
Has Michigan ever resorted to rolling blackouts? I guess these events are also called load shedding. This is where electricity is stopped purposely for periods of time that don't overlap and done in different parts of the grid. Has that happened, or is that on your radar?
It's not happened in recent history, and we have procedures for that. On the hottest peak days in the summer, when it's sweltering out, when people have their air conditioning up and Michigan's economy is really humming along, which it is starting to improve greatly, by the way, during that time, we have what's called a peak load, and we have a lot of peak load procedures, but our system, because of the investments we've made, has really held up. We've seen a 60% improvement or reduction in the amount of outages we have on that very peak load condition or that peak load day, and that's, again, investments in transformers and the like. But if, in fact, we were to get into a situation where we needed to load shed, we have a very systematic way of going through the state to reduce the load to customers. But again, because of our engineering practices, our foresight, our investments, we don't intend to use that, but we are prepared should we need to.
As long as you're here, real quickly, Garrick, where's the debate over deregulation in Michigan right now, in your view?
Well, you know, it's an ongoing debate, and from a consumer's energy perspective, you know, volatility of the electric market is amazing. Think of, I mean, you just can't store electricity. I mean, yeah, you can put it in a battery, but there's really not such a thing as a large battery bank. You just can't store it. And people, it's a necessity of life. I mean, literally, when power goes out, people's lives change. And we think an important commodity like that, we think we're a low-cost provider within the state for electricity. And we believe really that, you know, moving toward a more regulated model, but being competitive in that, which
okay.
we are,
All right.
is appropriate. So.
We got to let her go. Garrick Rochow is Vice President of Energy Delivery for Consumers Energy. Garrick, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thanks.
'60s era baseball was one of the highlight activities at Dearborn's Greenfield Village this past weekend. The Saginaw Old Golds Club retained its crown at the World Tournament of Historic Baseball. The old-time baseball season extends into the fall with future Michigan tournaments ahead. WKAR's Peter Wharf was at Greenfield Village with Old Golds player Michael Ossie.
I've been playing for about 11 years.
How'd you get into it?
I worked here at Greenfield Village, and then after I left college, I continued as a volunteer. So I volunteered here at the Village for a number of years, and now I'm playing and volunteering with the Saginaw team.
I assume you know, you played baseball as a kid and made this transition to this kind of different game. Is that right?
Yeah, I think it's funny. I think somebody told me one time there comes a time when they tell you you have to stop playing the child's game. And for most of us, that happened when we were 18. But this gives us an opportunity to come out and play and then also teach people, because Greenfield Village is a good place. You know, people come here to learn, be entertained as well. So it's a way to entertain people, but also give them the story of America's pastime, show them how baseball began.
Foul.
Just kind of give me the 60-second version of some of the big differences in the game from what we know today.
Sure. I mean, when the first thing you notice is that we don't use gloves. Gloves weren't really invented and used until the 1880s. And the other differences include if you catch a foul ball on the first bounce, it's an out. And if that's something that's obviously not a part of today's game, in 1867, which is a game that's here at the World Tournament, it was right in a transition year from when it became an amateur game to a professional game. So it's right on the cusp of what we do for baseball today, but there's still some inherent differences, like the bound rule, like the lack of gloves, and the underhand pitching, obviously. Those are the major differences that you'll see out here. Other than that, it's baseball, and that's what's interesting about it. It hasn't changed too much. It's tweaked. It's more competitive now, but the inherent game itself is about the same.
Strike one. No tick. No tick. No, Sarah.
Tell me about some of the teams in the region. I know there's teams throughout Michigan, even like Indiana and Ohio, right?
That's correct. I mean, when I started playing, there was about 90 teams. Most of it was in the Midwest. Now there's over 500 teams in the country. It's coast to coast. There's a lot of teams in the East Coast. We played a tournament in Gettysburg, actually, this year. We played teams from Delaware, Maryland, Boston, Providence. And this tournament is a reflection of a Midwest team. So it's a lot of Ohio, a lot of Michigan. And Ohio is the birthplace of this. It started in Columbus in 1982 and trickled over to Michigan in the mid-90s. And so it's been here at the Village since 1992. This is the 11th year. The 22nd year it's been here.
Again, ladies and gentlemen, let's have three cheers for the Iron Horse. Rip, rip.
Huzzah!
Rip, rip.
Huzzah!
Rip, rip.
Huzzah!
Tell me, kind of set the scene, what's happening here today?
This is a recreation of an actual tournament that occurred in Detroit in 1867. It was played in October down basically where Grand Circus Park is now. Teams from all over the country came for the first ever World's Tournament of Baseball. It was won by a team named the Unknowns, which is a team out of Jackson, Michigan. And they beat a team that was supposed to win called the Allegheny team from Pennsylvania, who was a powerhouse, but this kind of ragtag group from Jackson upset them. This tournament is a recreation of that, and that's what we're doing here today.
Tell me about your team, the Old Golds here from Saginaw, and like these knuckleheads laying over here.
Well, these guys are a pretty ragtag bunch. They try pretty hard. Our captain,
Shut up, bat boy.
Our captain Squints McCauley does a good job keeping us in line, and I think we do a pretty good job of playing ball the way it was supposed to be played in 1867 and showing people how the game was.
What position do you play?
I play third base.
Hot corner.
It's a little hotter without a glove on, too.
Shortstop in the last inning was taking a beating out there.
Yeah, you know, their shortstop for the Unknowns team is a good friend of mine. He's a very good player named Matt Vallant. But as you can see what's going on right behind us, it's about survival out there. You knock the ball down, you try to think of it like it's an egg, and you have to do the best you can.
Michael Ossie of the Saginaw Old Golds here at the World Series of Historic Baseball. Michael, thank you.
Thank you so much for your time. Thanks for coming out tonight.
For Kern State, this is Peter Worf.
Kern State here on 90.5 WKAR. Welcome back. It's Wednesday and time for our Neighbors in Action segment, where we feature people and organizations working to make our community a better place. This week, we take a look at Elder Law of Michigan. The nonprofit offers legal advice, training, and professional services for senior citizens, and we welcome Ron Tatro, who is Associate Vice President at Elder Law of Michigan. Welcome, Ron.
Good morning, Mark.
Tell us about some of the key services that you offer at Elder Law of Michigan.
Elder Law of Michigan is a nonprofit organization that's been around about 23 years, and our focus is really to provide a variety of services, all free of charge, to older residents of the state. Some of those services that we provide is free legal advice. We run a hotline for Michigan seniors, and that affords the opportunity for seniors to call and visit with an attorney about any legal issue that they may wish to discuss. And those can be issues such as Medicare and Medicaid issues. Those could be housing issues. Those could be consumer issues. Those could be a host of any issues.
Would you say that's the heart of the services that you offer? I mean, the name of the group is Elder Law of Michigan.
It is. Elder Law was the focus of the program when it started the 23 years ago and continues to be the cornerstone of what we do today in the delivery of services. But in addition to that, we have grown, as have many other nonprofits, and we provide many other services to augment and support the hotline.
So, yeah, I know that the needs and the nature of the older population is changing, and poverty is increasingly an issue amongst the elderly. How are you dealing with that?
We're dealing with poverty in a couple of different ways. First of all, we have a program called My Cafe, which stands for Michigan Coordinated Access to Food for the Elderly. We work in more than 30 counties of the state in which we help seniors identify potential food benefits that they are eligible for. We help them complete applications that are then submitted to the Department of Human Services, who determines their actual eligibility. And we help them navigate the system to make better use of those benefits. In addition to that, another service that we provide is called the Benefits Enrollment and Option Center. And through that process, residents of the state can take a look at whatever potential benefits they might be eligible for. We have somewhere in the range of 35 to 40 different benefits that we can screen potential applicants for. Some of those benefits might include things such as free telephones, assistance with paying taxes, heat support and cold weather, and those types of things. So we're trying to address poverty in a couple of different ways.
Is growing poverty a pretty noticeable shift in recent years?
It is. Certainly the recession has taken its toll on seniors as well as all other aspects of society. And what we've seen is that as people have had to step back from the workplace because of the recession, that they have turned to the older members in their life for some sort of economic support. In turn, that has impacted the ability of those seniors to provide that support that they need. Seniors many times are the only ones in a family that may have a steady stream of income, such as Social Security or retirement investments or some other things.
And demographically, I've heard many times that the old is America's fastest growing demographic segment. Am I right?
You are correct. It is estimated that by 2040, 2045, we will have somewhere in the range of 85 million people over the age of 65 in this country. That is when we will see the baby boomers come into really full bloom. ironically, our fastest growing group of people that we have by ratio is our centurions. Around 2030, we will have somewhere in excess of 600,000 people in this country over the age of 100.
Wow. Another issue that seniors face periodically or regularly is abuse. How do you deal with that?
We've always dealt with elder abuse or elder mistreatment since the beginning of our program, and the first way we dealt with it was through the advice that our attorneys were giving to either victims or caregivers or other folks that found themselves in those situations that resulted in abuse. In the past 10 years, we have moved to take a much more proactive approach by working with other professionals to address not only the investigation, the resolution of cases, but to look at the causation of elder abuse. The services that we provide are mostly to professionals. We are engaged in training professionals such as criminal justice professionals, and that is judges and prosecutors and law enforcement, along with human service professionals in the community, and that can range from people in mental health to medical services to housing services, on how best to identify elder abuse cases, how best to investigate those cases, and how best to utilize community resources to resolve those cases. In the past half a dozen years, we've probably trained somewhere between 1,000 and 2,000 professionals throughout the state. And in addition to that, we've been working with the 40 to 50 local-based coalitions throughout the state.
A lot of our Neighbors in Action segments involve very small staffs. Elder Law of Michigan sounds like you've got a lot of people working for you.
We do not have a lot of people.
Oh, okay.
We just ask a lot of the people that do work for us. In all our programs, our staff runs in the range of about 30 to 35 people, and that includes both full and part-time people. But we ask our people to multitask. We have a very integrated organization that really affords us the flexibility to move staff back and forth to meet our demands and our needs of the clients.
I know you're based here in Lansing, Ron, but do you have offices around the state?
We have a very strong presence in Wayne County, and we have two staff people that work in Wayne County for us.
Okay. Now, what are some of the more common concerns for your clients? Is the legal advice still the most in-demand service that you offer?
Demand many times really fluctuates by what's happening in society and what our immediate needs are. Mm. Demand always remains strong for legal services. But in the last few years, one of the areas that we've spent more and more time on is working on housing. Housing in the sense of reverse mortgages, housing in the sense of foreclosures, housing in the sense of evictions. We have a program that has been established to provide housing counseling and helping services, including legal services to help support that process. So our demand is currently quite strong for those types of services that deal with housing issues and the unfortunate circumstances that people find themselves in as it relates to their housing environment.
Another more recent service that I'm under the impression this is a more recent service that you've added is protecting pensions, which has become a much bigger issue with the municipal bankruptcies and the public pensions that people previously could count on.
That is true. We have a program called the Mid-America Pension Rights Project, in which we partner with colleagues in five other states to look at how best to help people preserve those pensions, or in some cases even identify them or obtain them. As an example, when the auto industry went through the bailout, one of the things that came out of that transition was moving pensions for auto workers from the auto industry to the unions, who took them over and established private organizations to facilitate that. As you might expect, in any sort of transition of that scale, there's always issues, there are always challenges that came out of that. And our pension attorneys were able to work with clients to help them address some of those issues.
Ron Tatro is our guest. He is Associate Vice President at Elder Law of Michigan. We're talking about what Elder Law of Michigan does, its role. your associate vice president, how directly do you work with your clients? I'm wondering if you could share an account of a way that you have helped a particular client that might capture your mission.
The short answer is I don't work with clients as much as I would like to because okay. I have a lot of other commitments and a lot of other responsibilities to take takes my time. However, we still do have a lot of interaction. And I guess the one story I would share with you that I always think back to was an older gentleman in his 80s who called me one day from Ann Arbor, who expressed concern about his living environment and what was happening to him and felt that he was a victim of abuse and domestic violence. Trust was obviously a concern that he had and who he could deal with, and he and I actually had a number of conversations about his environment. Subsequently, I arranged for him to go to a local fast food restaurant where he met an outreach worker from the local domestic violence program, and they met and they had coffee, and subsequently was able to work with him and create a safe environment for him to relocate into.
Okay.
Just one example of hundreds.
And if people want to access Elder Law's services, how do they do that?
They can call a toll-free number. It is 866-400-9164.
866-400-9164. Ron Tatro serves as the Associate Vice President at Elder Law of Michigan, which is a nonprofit agency that focuses on legal assistance for elders. Ron, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Current State could always use more nominations, and we know that there are great people and organizations out there that are doing great work. We just don't know about them. If you'd like to be one of them featured on our Neighbors in Action segment, please send us an email to currentstate@wkar.org. Put Neighbors in Action in the subject line and tell us why you think they should be featured for the great work they do. The 8th edition of the Renegade Theater Festival in Old Town Lansing starts Thursday. Events are planned at several locations over 3 days, with a number of local theater companies taking part. Joining us today for a preview are organizers Chad Bajero and Melissa Kaplan. Chad's the founder and artistic director of Lansing's Peppermint Creek Theater Company. Hi, Chad.
Hi, how are you?
Welcome to Current State.
Thank you.
And Melissa is the performing arts coordinator at Lansing Community College.
Hello?
I'm Melissa.
Thanks for
having
us.
Can I have one of your jobs when you're done with them?
Absolutely. We'd love to trade, actually.
I do not want to trade. I'm sorry. You can have Melissa.
I shouldn't have said that.
I love my job.
Edit that segment, please. No, they sound like really rewarding gigs.
Absolutely. They absolutely are. The reason your job's of interest, Chad and I also just started a radio show, and we're having a lot of fun and learning a lot. But listening to you and your polish and this program
I was
itself
just thinking, is,
oh my.
Polish is
you know,
like,
it's
wow,
great.
I could really learn something from that. That intro was really strong.
We'll job shadow you.
Yeah.
How about that?
I would love that.
So is the Renegade Theater Festival as subversive as it sounds?
It's subversive, and let me tell you, I'm even reminded sometimes about how subversive it is. For example, like one of the newspapers asked, well, can you send us some photos of shows that are going to be happening
of
this
Renegades.
Year?
Renegades.
Yeah, and I thought to myself, I'd love to do that, but we don't even know what the shows are going to look like until like we open, the day we open. I mean, we kind of create the playground for all of these shows to happen, and we invite them to come, and we have some minimal sort of restrictions like time and, you know, semi-appropriateness, I guess. But beyond that, we just kind of create the place for these things to happen and for people to come together for this festival, but we don't know what it's going to feel like. And so there's a thrill, I think, every year as we begin for us as organizers to see what is going to happen. Like, what are people going to respond to? What is going to be the show that everyone has to go see, and what's going to get people talking? And so I do think it's I don't know if subversive is necessarily the word, but renegade is certainly the word.
Yes, there's a lot of opportunity for companies to and individuals to experiment, and I think the idea of Renegade is that it isn't heavily produced. I always think of it kind of low to the ground. Though as participants come in, they want to add some bells and whistles. But unlike a fully staged production that you might buy a ticket to and see during a theater company's regular season, you might be seeing people, you know, without costumes, without a set, but and performing and doing a reading with music stands and on stools, or they might be doing something that's been staged fairly quickly. So it's not necessarily fully produced. There are a lot of new works. There's an opportunity for independent artists as well as Lansing area theater companies to participate. So for independent artists to be able to write something and produce it, or to have a piece of theater that they are in love with, but they don't have a venue. They don't have the mechanism behind them to produce it themselves. Renegade is a great place for them to do that.
So there is an unfinished quality to a lot of what
yes.
goes
so,
on.
Yeah,
there.
I think what we are less concerned about, yeah, it being really polished and being like a typical, like what we think of as a polished theater performance during the regular season. And we are more concerned about bringing as many theatrical opportunities into one place so that people can be exposed for free to as many different types of theater experiences, and so we're less concerned about that.
Right, and it's not to say that there's not a high level of quality in terms of performance and storytelling and writing. You have some very top-notch playwrights who are involved in this. Williamston Theater, for example, is bringing a play by Joseph Zettelmeyer. It'll be a reading, so it's not fully staged. They'll have their Williamston Theater professional actors doing that reading, so excellent performers, but it's a bit in development.
I think it's fascinating because in recent years there's been so much more exposure of the process. And I think an mm-hmm. awful lot of people are just as interested in what goes on behind the scenes.
Oh, absolutely.
And, you know, to sit in, it's one thing to see a great play, but to sit in on a rehearsal
yes.
of that great play,
and
that's almost as good.
Yeah.
You
to know? Have a chance share your ideas, too, and be asked for your input. So you might have, make me laugh, or I didn't understand that, or I hated that.
So that kind of thing happens as well.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think specifically as part of our new original works portion, I mean, these are plays that have never been done on stage. They haven't ever been read out loud, even. And then they're followed up by a talkback with the cast and crew or the directors. And I think that is an awesome, and Williamson is the same way. I mean, they're typically producing plays that are going to be later on fully staged in their season, and they're using this as an opportunity to read it out loud and get audience feedback. Like, what do you like? And so what audiences say about it very much will work into what eventually will be a full stage production of that. So that's a really thrilling experience, I think, for audiences
it
to
is.
Know they're part of that.
We're talking with Chad Bajero and Melissa Kaplan of the Renegade Theater Festival in Old Town Lansing, which kicks off tomorrow. Are your playwrights predominantly local or regional people, or
regional.
Do they come from further afield?
They're regional right now. The new original works portion of Renegade, which was started a couple years ago specifically to encourage the development of new plays, we do solicit throughout the state and the region for new plays to be submitted in the spring, and then half a dozen or so are selected for readings, and they're matched with a director. And that is a portion of the festival, along with the local theaters and independent producers, but the development of new plays is something that we're really committed to growing this year and in future years. And we're, for the first time, going to be offering or recognizing those with a playwriting award for the best new play. And the person, the playwright who's selected, will have one of their plays presented during Peppermint Creek Theater's regular 2013-14 season. So we think there's a great opportunity in the Lansing for Lansing to be a center of new play development, even more than it already is.
Playwrights must love this event.
Well, we hope so, because I don't know if they, you know, we're not necessarily as a town or state known for offering a lot of opportunities for local and just playwrights, new playwrights in general. And so I hope that they do. I hope that they realize that we're trying to create a space and an opportunity for them to have their work seen, whether, and it doesn't have to be tested. I think that a lot of times as theater groups in this area, we want to know that it's a tested script, that audiences already love it. And so there's a kind of a risk or a danger involved in trying a new script that has never been seen. And so we're really trying to put our money where our mouth is and say, we believe in you, whatever
that
is.
What I find interesting, too, is that theater people, forgive me for indulging in a stereotype here, but I mean, they have a thing about control sometimes. And you are turning, it sounds like you're turning that on its head.
That's what we
really
love
in
about
a way.
Renegade, and
yeah.
That is the spirit of Renegade. And that, I think, is where the Renegade aspect comes in, that danger, that risk.
Yeah.
And, yeah, everybody needs to let go a little bit and see what happens and take those risks. And we create that environment where they can do that.
I'm sure we've captured a lot of people's attention here with the way you've described your event. Where and when does it happen?
Absolutely. We start tomorrow, which is Thursday, Friday and Saturday, August 15th, 16th, and 17th. It's in Lansing's Old Town, all over. And shows are at 7 and 9 on Thursday and Friday and 3 and 5 on Saturday, as well as Renegade Kids, which is happening at 11 and 12 on Saturday. And we have a special new teen portion, which we're really excited about, where teens can come and they're going to be part of a workshop throughout the day to create a theater piece that will then be presented that night for the Pulsar Awards, which starts at 8 o'clock. And they can go to our website, which is renegadetheaterfestival.org.
And I just want to quickly thank our – we have wonderful sponsors who have been committed over the years to this, Lansing City Pulse, Lansing Community College, Old Town Commercial Association, Message Makers, MICA, Gallery, and all the venues, the businesses that open their doors and let us perform there, Absolute Gallery, Chrome Cap,
Old Town
General Store.
How many are there all together?
Turner Dodge Mansion.
We have six spaces this year that are just dedicated to all of our shows. And as Melissa said, they are all seven. There's seven. And they're all donating this space to us, which there's no way, literally, that we would be able to do the festival if they didn't say, yep, you can use it, and we're going to give you the keys, and we're going to let you come in and produce this theater that we also have no idea how they're going to
do. Everything from a business that generally has a building that is not open right now, it's a closed business, to the Turner Dodge House. And galleries and Old Town General Store in between. It's wonderful.
Sounds like fun. Website again, one more time, Renegade Theater.
Festival.org.
Renegade Theater Festival.
And we're on Facebook and Tumblr and Twitter.
Yep. All of those places, too. Chad Bajero is the founder and artistic director of Lansing's Peppermint Creek Theater Company, and Melissa Kaplan is the performing arts coordinator at Lansing Community College. Thanks to both of you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Tomorrow on Current State, we discuss the possibility of decriminalizing marijuana in Lansing, small amounts of it anyway. Also, a tour of one of the U.S. Navy's most distinguished submarines of World War II, the USS Silversides, here in Michigan. All that and more Thursday on Current State. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Wharf. Joe Lindstroth is the producer. Thanks as well to producer Emmanuel Berry and to Aaron Young for engineering. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.